Hey, this is Rob Liefeld, and you're listening to Matt, Ian, and Paul on the McSauce Podcast.
Welcome to episode 364 of the McSauce Podcast. My name is Paul McGinty. With me, as always, are Ian Sharpley.
Hello.
And Matt Cassell.
Hello.
It is Monday night, March 15th. And tonight, I promise you, we are going to talk about the Stanley Ben Cooper fiasco.
Promises. Didn't you promise?
How is it a Stan Lee fiasco?
It wasn't a promise. It wasn't a promise last week.
Wait, how's it a Stan Lee fiasco?
Well, Matt, that's part of the tease. We're going to learn just how Stan Lee stole the Spider-Man costume from one Ben Cooper.
Just like he stole everything else.
Matt, when you texted us earlier, we need to do the Ben Cooper thing. Like, I read it as D.B. Cooper, and I was like, why are we talking about D.B. Cooper?
Who's D.B. Cooper?
That mysterious guy that like jumped out of a plane with like a bag of money and they found.
Yeah, different guy.
Yeah, different Cooper.
Only slightly. One was a mask maker. The other was a
was Loki.
Yes,
according to the new Loki trailers. But we're also going to talk fantasy, not what Ian likes in the bedroom kind of fantasy, but dragons and wizards. Type of fantasy, which there may be a Venn crossover.
There might be.
But before we do that, we talk housekeeping with Ian Sharpley.
Go to McSauce.com, home of all of your fantasies. D.B. Cooper jumping out of an airplane with,
everyone, D.B. Cooper, Ben Cooper, Anderson Cooper.
Every Cooper will jump out of the airplane in whatever attire that you wish them to on McSauce.com. You can also go to all of our social media sites such as Instagram, YouTube, Twitter. We also have a Patreon. If you put down $5 and select our Patreon as your official Patreon that you're going to subscribe to, we will give you a special episode catered to all the likes and all your fantasies that you put down on the survey that we send over to you. So go to patreon.com, type in MCSOSS, and we can send you over a special episode as well as the archive of the other episodes that we've done on our exclusive feed there.
Video games, music, television, all kinds of cool stuff on the Patreon. I'm not fucking with you. It's pretty neat.
We would never fuck with you.
Well, I think
Male
there's
living doing it.
It's a good thing intern Andy doesn't have all that keyed up to find all the times we actually fucked with people during the podcast.
It's a good thing he doesn't have mouths to feed or anything like that. He's just doing it for the love of the game at this point.
So why don't we jump into the show? Last week, we teased you that we were going to talk Ben Cooper, and we're going to do it right now.
I feel like the fans have no idea what Ben Cooper is. We keep saying Ben Cooper.
The
like,
real fans. The real. If you know, you know.
Nobody knows.
If you know, you know.
Well,
if you don't,
listener,
now you're going to learn.
Now you okay. So Ben Cooper was, Paul.
Famous pedophile.
Well.
What?
Unconfirmed.
I just made it up.
Ben Cooper was a Halloween costume manufacturer that operated way, way, way back in the 50s, possibly before. I didn't look that closely into it, but they operated until like 1991 when they were bought out by another Halloween costume creator. But in 1954, Paul, that is 8 years before Stan Lee and or Jack Kirby and or Steve Ditko created Marvel's Spider-Man. Ben Cooper Costumes created a costume, Ian, called Spider-Man. Spider, space, man, no hyphen.
No, not an actual astronaut, just a space.
It's just a space. Just a space bar.
We've all seen Ben Cooper costumes. We've owned Ben Cooper costumes. It's the sharp plastic mask with the elastic string, the plastic jumpsuit.
If it didn't cut your lips off going on in the front, it'd probably snap the back of your neck with that tight elastic.
Ooh, yeah, band. It would dig into where my ears meet my head. I used the Optimus. I had Optimus Prime, of course. Why wouldn't I? I used to use because the bodysuit was plastic. You just like slipped it over your front.
It's very generous to call a bib a body part. It was like, well, you could be a transformer and go to Red Lobster if
it
you
did
wanted.
Cover your entire body. Like you stepped into it.
It was a bib.
You put your legs in and you put your arms in and then it like tied bib. Up the back. But I would use it to slide down my carpeted stairs. Because you'd get some real...
You know, as Optimus Prime used to do.
It's in every episode of the show.
Autobots, slide down.
Slide out.
Down the stairs.
Yeah, dangerous. But man, did I have a lot of fun doing that.
We did that, but we used sleeping bags. We didn't
we did
necessarily get
bags.
Dressed up. Yeah. Like,
well, I didn't put on a bow tie with it.
Well, okay, so Ben Cooper, Paul, before they were making Optimus Prime costumes, they were creating a costume called Spider-Man. And their costume had some similarities to what Marvel ended up coming up with for their Spider-Man character. It was a yellow and black costume. As you know, Paul, Spider-Man's costume is red and blue and black. But this was yellow and black. But the thing is, it had the iconic spider web pattern, particularly on the face that radiated like from the center of the face out, like around the head. And those are some pretty striking similarities. Also, as it is rumored, Jack Kirby was the first artist to take a stab at drawing Spider-Man. As it turns out, there are rumors that Jack Kirby worked at Ben Cooper Halloween costumes years before Spider-Man
that I didn't
Marvel
know
was
before
created.
I read the article. And after I read that, I was like, oh. Well, I didn't know Jack Kirby did that. Like, I knew he took his first stab at the Spider-Man costume, but I didn't. Like, I was reading that article, and I'm like, all right, when are we going to get to the... When are we going to get to the problem here? And then they were like, oh, Jack Kirby used to work there. And I'm like, oh, okay. Now I know why this article was written in the first place.
Also, what's also interesting, the very first... Okay, so Spider-Man was created in 1962. It was like a year or two before you were born, Paul.
A couple months.
So he's created in 62. The very first piece of Marvel Comics merchandise ever created... was a Spider-Man costume created by Ben Cooper Costumes. So, I don't know. Was there some kind of deal put in place? Obviously, nobody at Marvel is going to say, oh, yeah, we did kind of swipe that, because there may or may not be some kind of lawsuit.
If there was a conspiracy over the Wonder Man costume... Maybe Marvel would just be like, oh, yeah, we kind of took that.
Yeah.
But since it's Spider-Man.
You might think that they made some kind of backroom deal. No, of course, this was before Spider-Man became a multi-billion-dollar property.
Right. It's when, like, even before he was famous on the Electric Company.
Yeah.
There seems to have been a deal in place that, like, Ben Cooper shows up at Marvel headquarters and is like, hey, you guys fucking stole this. And they were like, well, sort of. But how about we do this? How about we give you first licensing rights for the actual for the one we did, the Red and Blue Spider-Man, because it's going to be a pretty big book, or it is a pretty big book. I think when it, like I think it was already a popular comic when this happened, or else how would Ben Cooper even show up there? Like, hey, this thing that I keep seeing everywhere, like. And they were like, we'll give you licensing rights. You can make the costume. And that was the, hey, we'll give you this so you don't take us to the county magistrate.
The county magistrate. here's the interesting thing. We don't know what Jack Kirby created for his first attempt at Spider-Man. You know, a lot of people speculate that, you know, the design might not have been right. Is it possible, Ian, that the design was pretty much the design, but it was more the stature and the physique that didn't feel right? Because as we all know, Jack Kirby draws big, heroic, super muscular, you know, really dense-looking characters, whereas Steve Ditko drew a much lankier, skinnier, kind of more puny-looking hero.
Yeah, Steve Ditko drew more regular proportions.
Right. And this is kind of like one of those comic book mysteries that may never be solved. But like, is it possible that Jack Kirby really did design what Spider-Man looks like based on his exposure to the Ben Cooper design, which when you look at it, Ian, are we going to have pictures of this on our socials?
We sure can, Matt.
Okay. So you'll be able to see the pictures of what it looks like side by side. I don't think it's a coincidence. I think there's definitely somebody was influenced by that costume.
I thought in the article there was also some allusion to the black and yellow costume was designed by Jack Kirby.
I don't remember reading that angle.
No one explicitly said that, but I thought that it was just illusion that, well, Jack Kirby's there, so maybe Jack Kirby took something he did there and like repurposed it for Stan Lee. So maybe Lee saw that the black and yellow version at some point, and then he was like, meh.
Well, Stan Lee came up with Spider-Man, right? That was that was indisputably Stan Lee, right? And the question is, like, who came up with the visual component?
Right.
If Stan Lee was like, hey, I have an idea, Spider-Man, Jack Kirby might have been like, oh,
hey,
I just did
something like this.
Or, you know, Joe Bob created a Spider-Man costume. I can just swipe that and, you know.
Yeah, like the article also made it sound like the Marvel offices and the Ben Cooper offices were also pretty close to each other. So, like, someone may have seen, it wouldn't have been out of the ordinary, even for Steve Ditko to have seen, like, that black and yellow Spider-Man costume at some point.
I don't think that it's like, I don't think that's even relevant. That part I didn't find relevant because this isn't a costume that never made it onto store shelves. It was sold nationwide.
Yeah.
So anybody could have been influenced by it. But anyway, I think it's pretty fascinating to see that if you ask me, I feel that this is pretty definitive that this is where the inspiration came from for the Spider-Man costume. What I want to know is who created the Spider-Man at Ben Cooper, because that's the real creator of Spider-Man.
Yeah, it's an interesting wrinkle to one of comics' greatest mysteries.
Like, I was about to say, there's no mystery on who created Batman. Actually, there is some debate on Batman. Maybe that's not the best example, but Superman. Mm-hmm. There's no debate on who created Superman, Paul.
No, there isn't. Is there?
It was
Siegel and Schuster. They drew it.
Zack Snyder.
Wrote it. Well, that's the good one. That's the good version.
Yeah, I mean, Matt is correct.
After millennia, we finally get a good Superman. It's in black and white.
Yep. It was Simon and Schuster.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, Siegel and Schuster.
Is Simon and Schuster?
Joe Simon was Captain America.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Siegel and Schuster.
Jesus Christ.
Stay in your lane, Marvel, Matt.
Sorry. I only have so much information I can retain in this little brain, and this Ben Cooper thing was about all I could handle, so the rest is just like gibberish.
That'll do it for Matt tonight, everyone.
I'm going to power down for a while here.
Ian, you've been awfully quiet over there. Are you compiling Ben Cooper Spider-Man images? You getting the socials all set up?
You know, we've just started recording, right?
I'm just letting you guys really drop knowledge bombs all over the place here.
What do you think about this knowledge? What do you think about the mystery around the Spider-Man
looks
costume?
Looks like some intellectual property theft, if you ask me. That's what it looks like to me. Those Marvel offices weren't really all that close. They're 10 miles apart in New York. So, I mean, yeah. I guess that's...
Like Matt
that's
said, though,
close,
inconsequential.
But, yeah, like, I don't think that part has anything to do
remember,
with
remember
the fact
19...
that they were on store shelves and somebody was like, that looks pretty cool. I think I'll use that.
Remember
with
1959, they called it Halloween of the Spider-Man when everyone had black and yellow Spider-Man costumes. I mean, that seems pretty definitive that Stan Lee would be like, hey, well, I've got an idea here.
Horrible Stan Lee impression.
That was a really good Stan
just
Lee.
Terrible.
That's what he sounded like when he was young, slamming puss in downtown Manhattan.
Is that what he was doing? Is that what Stan
you
Lee...
saw the Playboy
like,
spread. Of
yeah,
course
but,
he was.
But that was after he became rich and famous. The 70s, Stan Lee was definitely slamming, as you would put it.
You don't.
Puss.
You think... You think that he couldn't do it before he got rich and famous?
I don't think that he was doing it.
You don't think he had the guile to get it done?
I don't think he was, but he definitely was in the 70s. Just look at him. Look at 1970s Stan Lee.
Didn't
he
meet
having
his wife then, though?
He always had a wife.
Yeah, because that always stops people.
But he was slamming puss.
I urge anybody to go onto YouTube and watch old interviews with Stan Lee from the 70s, particularly. Any interview with Stan Lee is gold, but particularly the 70s.
I mean,
there's
just get the fuck out of the city. Like, that guy was having a lot of
Ian just pulled up a picture of 1970s Stan Lee. You know, it's very interesting because Stan Lee was an older man in the 70s.
Or maybe, well, yeah. I feel like everyone just looked older.
No, I think he was what, pushing 60?
I can't count. But yes.
Right around the time he died, there was a video going around. I think it was either right when he started at Marvel or before. It was black and white. He didn't have a mustache. It was just like in
before the sunglasses.
Some interview, right? Yeah. And it was so weird seeing this Stan Lee before he was quote unquote Stan Lee with the mustache and the glasses.
They called him Stan the Man Lee.
Yeah. It was just so like neat and interesting seeing like this guy that.
Yeah. You know, I what I'll say about Stan Lee is that, especially watching these interviews from the 70s and, hearing him talk about comic books, he didn't really talk about the characters, which is funny because he's so known for creating these icons. But what I feel like as the years go by, he's kind of forgotten as a storyteller. And he talks about the stories and the situations that he's putting these characters in. And I feel like it's important to not forget that aspect of what he did as a creator, because the characters would have never withstood any kind of test of time if he hadn't created these great stories to go along with them. And it was very interesting in how Marvel's philosophy was trying to make these books for a slightly older audience. You know, today's standards are so mainstream and there's nothing edgy about them, but at the time they were edgier than the distinguished competition.
Yeah,
and he was trying to incorporate real life situations into these like fantastical characters, and it was kind of a shared philosophy that Marvel had. I mean, there weren't that many creators; there was like six or seven writers, and that was about it at the time, which probably helped make it feel like a connected universe as opposed to modern comics. I think modern creators would do well to maybe study some old Stan Lee stuff. I think they would create better content if they were a little bit more aware of his legacy.
I think that there's something to be said about the bullpen sort of theory of when you have everybody in one office or one environment, you're kind of vibing off of everybody's creative springboards, if you will. So everybody is sort of going in similar, in a similar direction or thinking in a similar manner because you're talking to each other and you're exploring stories together or coming up with the seeds of stories together. So that probably also has a lot to do with why it felt so interconnected, was that everybody was essentially working in the same office, where as now, especially now, the way that work is sort of disjointed and people can work all across the globe, you get a lot of great talent doing that, but I don't think you have the same kind of cohesion that you would have back in the day.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think it's kind of sad that there isn't at Marvel that synergy that might have used to exist or maybe exists with other smaller publishers. Like, I always cite Valiant as a quality connected universe that I haven't read much Valiant in the last couple of years, but when Valiant relaunched in 2011, I was pretty like all in on it. And I was really enjoying it for a while there because there was a sense of like connectivity and it wasn't too big or overwhelming. It felt like you could still kind of like keep up with it. And I mean, those are like the early days of Image Comics too. The early days of Image, it was a connected universe. It was so fun. And now there's nothing connecting Image books. Nothing.
Yeah. I really liked whenever, probably the first 3 years, somewhere around there, of Image books. And whenever you get into the Image crossover, whenever the creators flip-flop books and
Image X month.
At the time, I didn't even know. It was a surprise, I felt. And I was, for the time, I was on the cutting edge of reading Wizard magazine and getting all the newest updates and solicitations. So I would kind of have an idea, but I felt like going into that month, I didn't know who was going to do what. So I had to make sure that I collected all those Image books to make sure that I got essentially the full story and the story from the creators that I wanted to see take on these new, like the different characters.
It's so funny. When we were 14, trying to collect all six issues felt like a monumental task. Like, oh man, that took a lot out of me. It's like six books. It's not that difficult.
Yeah, but I mean, it was, if you think back, you know, we're on allowances and you only had limited resources and you had to, all those books I would like pore over and reread and reread time and time again. So
it felt like every one of those six books was more or less phoned in. Nobody gave it their all because they weren't their characters. Even the beloved Eric Larson, I felt like, did not do his best work on Wildcats number 14. I think that Jim Lee, like, I don't even know if he drew Savage Dragon number 13. I feel like Brandon Choi or whatever his name did most of the artwork in it. Rob Liefeld.
Isn't Brandon Choi the writer, though?
Well, I don't know. I thought that he also did some of the artwork. Was there a different artist?
No,
was that all Jim Lee?
It was Jim Lee. It was not Jim Lee's best. It wasn't necessarily.
It was an
his
off
best.
Week.
The colorist on that book, I recently reread it, and the color is very sort of like samey and
monochromatic.
It doesn't jump out. There's a lot of like grays, blues, and greens, but nothing like stands apart. So you see a lot of the background flooding to the foreground, and maybe it just has to do with color theory of the 1990s and them not really understanding how to use the digital color
These were a bunch of guys. Days. Many of the colorists of the 90s were wielding power that they had no business wielding.
So they were still learning it.
It was similar to wielding the One Ring, Paul, okay?
Look at this guy.
Look at this guy. Segue expert, transition expert. That's why we, I was going to say employ you here, but
I do. Hey, listeners, I do this for free.
Well, not, you know, like we do make money from Patreon, but it all goes back into the product to give you high quality podcasting.
So before we were, started recording, Matt brought some real heat into the room for fantasy. A few weeks ago, we were talking about the Redwall, like, mice books. And, you know, Matt threw a book down on the table here, and I just saw the back of it. And I was like, oh, Matt, did you bring me one of those Redwall books to read? And you were like, no, it's something that I've never heard of before. It's David Eddings' The Belgariad. I don't think the word Belgariad is a very... I don't think it's easy to say. I don't think it's like a real hook, a real word that hooks you.
The Lord of the
Belgariad. I would have probably called it something different. But then again, I am not making David Eddings' Belgariad money. So who am I to say? But Matt, you bought that book. It looks like you're about an eighth of the way through. Right? That's where your bookmark is?
Well, it's three books in one.
Oh, you're what? Third of the way, maybe.
I just finished the first book.
This is book two?
No. This book that I'm holding is three books collected into one. And I just finished the first one of those three last night.
And this sparked fantasy fire in you.
Yeah, well, even before I got it, I had been sort of thinking, I want to immerse myself in a fantasy world. It didn't even have to be swords and sorceries.
This whole time, too.
Since last March.
It didn't have to be swords and sorcery. But I wanted it to be classic fantasy. And when
No spaceships.
Well, no, I mean like classic in terms of like the. I kind of wanted all of the sort of fantasy cliches to be kind of there, kind of like the peasant hero that rises up and, you know, becomes the savior or whatever. I wanted
hobbits,
the old mentor, the hero's journey stuff.
The old wizened wizard.
So I started researching, and I had a few different ideas on where I might go. I almost went with like a younger, kind of like more like almost child, like Narnia, like kind of age range, in a series called, actually, I don't know what the series is called, but it was by Lloyd Alexander. I think the second book in the series is The Black Cauldron.
Is that the Don Bluth movie?
I don't know if that was based from? On that. I don't Disney totally movie. Know.
Is Black Cauldron Disney?
Mm-hmm.
But the book, I don't know if it's the same thing or not. I assumed it was, you know. That would be weird if there's a book called The Black Cauldron, but it has nothing to do with the movie.
Like if there were two Spider-Mans.
How ironic.
So
you landed on the Belgariad.
I landed on the Belgariad. It seemed to me like it might be the most like Lord of the Rings. And Paul, I agree. Lord of the Rings has a very marketable sound to it.
It rolls off the tongue.
It rolls right off the tongue. Game of Thrones.
Oh my God, it fell on the floor. It rolled so quickly. Well,
Black Cauldron.
Right off my tongue. Right.
Yeah, I can't even keep it in my mouth.
The Belgaria. It's trapped my mouth.
I need floss.
I can't get it out.
The Belgariad.
The Belgariad sounds like you have a mouthful of marbles and you're trying
to. And there's even a question in how to pronounce it. I looked at it and I was like, is it Belgariad? Do we have a soft G?
Of course,
a hard G?
Of course you would make that kind
well,
of
well, because I know that this is Matt's book, and if I say it wrong, I'm gonna hear about it. So I needed to get it right.
So there's a character in the book. There's a god, and his name is Belgar. I fucked that up. I think it's
God damn it, Matt.
I think it's Belar.
But so it's not the Belgariad from Belgar.
I don't know why it's called the Belgariad yet. But
we're a book in. we're one third in.
Listen,
we should know.
There is a great sorcerer, and he's referred to as a few different names in the book. Originally, he's referred to as Mr. Wolf, and then
I'm already questioning this fantasy series, because I feel like if it's classic fantasy, like you were talking about, no one should be called Mister, right? But I guess Sam does call Frodo Mister. No, he calls him Master Frodo.
Even in the classic fantasy tale Pulp Fiction, they just refer to him as the Wolf, not the Mister. Wolf.
Yeah,
the
Mister Wolf sounds very real world. It Mister not takes me right out of the fantasy of it.
When they're talking to Mister, he's like, "No, no, that, no. Mister was my father."
That reminds me, one of the terms that I learned as I started going down the fantasy rabbit hole.
You can't say that whatever it is on this podcast, we'll be canceled.
What?
You said one of the terms that I learned as I'm going down this rabbit hole. Yeah. That sounds like radicalization.
So there fantasy seems to be referred to as two different kinds, high fantasy and low fantasy. And apparently high fantasy is when the whole world is like created new. It's this whole different, you know, world. So like Lord of the Rings, Game of Thrones, high fantasy. Low fantasy is
Harry Potter.
Taking the real world and adding in fantastical elements.
Oh, fantasy for dummies.
Fantasy adjacent.
So the Belgariad is high fantasy?
It's high fantasy, yeah.
I love it.
So it certainly has parallels to Lord of the Rings, in my opinion. There's a young farm boy. He is an orphan. He's raised by his aunt. He ends up going on a quest with a group of other characters. It's familiar.
Classic fantasy characters.
Yeah, like,
there's an archer and a mage.
No,
I
mean,
a dwarf, perhaps.
And a maid.
His. there aren't, like, from as of yet, I think that we're going to get into it more.
But you're a book in.
What?
You're a book in. How are we. Don't you know who he's going on this quest with?
No.
Is it not traditional, like. The traditional, like, what word am I looking for? The people that you are in fantasy.
Races?
Like, no.
Classes.
But there's like, yeah, there's like the magic guy, the archer. There's like magic guy and archer, like the strong guy, like that stuff.
Stereotypes, cliches. What? I don't know what you're trying to say.
Fantasy cliches for the characters.
Yeah, but not those ones. You do have the wizard, but he hasn't really used any wizard powers yet. There's also a female wizard with them. I'm not going to spoil too much. There's like a big kind of like Viking type character with them, and then there's more of a thieving kind of character. And then there's more like a common man who comes from like the same area as the main character. His name is Garion, who is... Right
I
now,
for a second, you were gonna say Gary, and I was gonna be like, "God
just
damn
Gary,
it,
yeah.
Mr. Wolf and Gary, get me out of here."
The Belgariad.
So,
oh boy.
So, Gary in the beginning of the story is very young. Should I just call him Gary?
Just call him Gary.
And as
this is the lowest of all low fantasy.
As
our hero, Gary.
Gary. as a young kid, he like gave him the name Mr. Wolf. I guess like people called him the Wolf or
what's
whatever.
What's the main character's name?
Gary.
Garyad. What is his name?
It's Gary.
It's just Gary.
It's Garion.
Garion. That's our hero.
That's the Luke Skywalker of this story. Keep going. So apparently like Mr. Wolf was known as like the Wolf or something, and young Gary was like, I want to call you Mr. Wolf. Is that okay? And then he was like, yeah, I kind of like that.
So he's already met the bad guy.
Mr. Wolf is a good guy.
Mm. How deceiving.
Yeah. It's a very like interesting kind of world that they built, because there's all these like different countries that make up like the greater kingdom, and each country feels like somewhat of a real life analog for like real countries. So like there's a country called Cherik, and that feels like some kind of like Scandinavian country. What's so funny?
Nothing. No. Just making jokes in my head.
There is a country called Drasnia that's kind of like Russia, and so on and so forth. So far, they haven't introduced us really to other like weird races and stuff like that. Like, there's no elves or dwarves or anything. But like all good fantasy books, Ian, as you know, in the front there is a map. They all have a map, which I can't even tell you how many times I'm like reading. I'm like, what the fuck is that? And I had to go go back to the front to understand where their journey is going. And when you see the map and you like see like a mountain range behind the city that they're going to, and then as the boat is going past and they say you have the gleaming towers or whatever, the city and the white caps of the mountains behind, like it helps you kind of paint like a much more vivid picture. And you know, this map is huge on the inside of this book, but their journey was like half a centimeter long. So like, I know that they're going to like go everywhere eventually, but it's proven to be a really good book. It's it definitely has a tamer kind of treatment than like a Game of Thrones. It's way more in line with Lord of the Rings, but I think it's more accessible than Lord of the Rings from like a prose standpoint. It's a really good read. I mean, like, we're all into that, this general like kind of somewhat stereotypical mythological story, and I would really recommend it to anybody that's into that stuff. Like, if you like Star Wars, then you'll probably like this.
So you're feeling the Garyad.
I'm feeling the Belgariad by David Eddings. This was written. This was considered the last of this kind of fantasy before you started getting into more complex themes.
When did this book come out?
1982.
Holy shit.
What?
I did not expect this to be an old book. I thought this was going to be something newer.
Oh, okay. It's, I mean, according to the cover, it is quite beloved, and it says millions of readers have discovered. So apparently it's been pretty popular. How we've never heard of it, I have no idea. But once I started going down the fantasy rabbit hole, because this opened a doorway to a whole other land for me, Paul, and I started to understand like the different kinds of fantasy that's out there and how this one is like PG-13 type storytelling. And then stuff that was written probably like in the 90s and in the 2000s is much more complex. It's much less black and white. There's a lot of gray area. It's your Game of Thrones and everything like it. And I've never read Game of Thrones, but obviously I've seen most of the seasons of it. It's fine. But 10 times out of 10, I will take Lord of the Rings over Game of Thrones. 10 times out of 10, I will take Star Wars over Lord of the Rings. 10 times out of 10, I will take Willow over Game of Thrones. Like those kind of classic tropes and classic storytelling is what I like. And that's okay if it gets a different paint job and it's kind of the same story. I like that. I don't care.
Yeah, I like a good old hero's journey. I never read the first Game of Thrones book. But then I talked to a couple buddies that read more of them and they're like, "Well, read like you'll like the first two, but then the third one is it's just all lineage. It's like a narrated bibliography of who's who, and then Jon Snow's not in this book at all, and then Tyrion's not in this other book." And I'm like, appeal of the books never resonated with me. But I like the show a lot, but at the same time, with the Game of Thrones show, I was like, oh, cool, there's going to be all this like fantasy stuff. And then there's like, no, it's all like strictly real world medieval plus three dragons. And I'm like, man, I wanted like, and there was like the magic of like the raising of the dead and the White Walkers and stuff. But I thought it was going to wind up being more,
you know,
more magical,
undead,
more
ice monsters, light fantasy,
maybe different race, like how Lord of the Rings has.
Yeah,
elves
I thought there would have been more
stuff.
Elves, wizards. Like I thought there would have been just more fantasy stuff that came up through, and it never really played out that way. I just finished Stephen King and Peter Straub's The Talisman, which is low fantasy because it uses our real world as a base. And
did you know it was low fantasy until 5 minutes ago?
No, I never would have called it that. I don't like the term low fantasy. Oh. It makes it sound worse. It makes it a negative. It's not like it doesn't sound just like a descriptor of this style versus this style. It sounds like, well, this is the high one and this is the low one.
But we like lowbrow humor, right? You know,
but it's not necessarily it's not taken as a positive.
What's that?
Lowbrow humor isn't taken as a positive. Like,
yeah, I know. I'm just saying
right.
that.
Yeah, there's a negative connotation. You take the high road instead of the low road.
Right. But I thought The Talisman was really good, and it was kind of funny as I was. It starts off pretty slow. It's about this kid. His mother's dying. They move to this like remote New England town so she can sort of quietly die, but it's part of this whole bigger plan.
Wait, a Stephen King book takes place in a New England town? Is that what
it
you're
does.
Telling me?
Yeah, I know. I was shocked. I was surprised.
That doesn't make any sense. I mean, usually,
I guess they can't all take place in Algeria.
But this kid learns that he can flip to essentially like Lord of the Rings world where all this crazy fantasy stuff happens, and then he can flip back and he can
I'm
he
looking
needs
at
to
the map for The Talisman, and it's just Massachusetts. It's just Boston.
So Jack, the main kid in the story, has to travel from like Boston to San
Southie.
Francisco to find the talisman in order to save his mother in the real world and this entire fantasy world that he flips back and forth in between.
Is this a series
all while
or
being,
a one-off?
It's a one-off, but there's a sequel called The Black House that I haven't read yet. I don't know what The Black House is
about.
So
it's not a one-off?
It was meant to be a one-off. I think... what is that? What am I looking at?
A
sexy bookmark.
A dork's bookmark.
Oh, a Star Wars bookmark. My bookmark is a Star Wars bookmark. There. This page is saved by a Jedi Master, and it's a picture of Yoda. I've had it since grade school. We are dorks. But yeah, I think The Talisman was supposed to be a one-off. I think it came out in like 87. And then years and years later, Stephen King and Peter Straub got together again, and they did another story in that world. I don't know if Jack Sawyer is the main character in it. Like it could be like the Cimmerillion, something totally different, you know, who knows, but I thought it funny. Like, I was reading it, and I was like, man, why the fuck hasn't anyone done this yet? This is, like, perfect for, like, a series or, like, a movie trilogy. Like, you could really do something with this.
It almost sounds like the premise would work as a young adult type fantasy.
Yeah, because the kids, like, I think he's 12. The main kid's 12. I'm like, this could totally, totally work for something. And then, you know, I was, you know, three quarters of the way through, and then just it was just announced that Steven Spielberg and the Duffer brothers are getting together to do The Talisman. And I was like, well, goddamn, isn't that perfect? Kids doing fantasy stuff, Steven Spielberg and the Duffer brothers. Awesome. Let's go.
Paul, have you read any other fantasy other than, like, Lord of the Rings or the first Game of Thrones? Or, well, I guess you read The Talisman.
I read the Dark Tower series.
Okay, well, that's fantasy.
It's low fantasy.
Low fantasy.
Gross fantasy. yeah, like, I haven't dipped into... Fantasy. I don't think I've really ever read high fantasy.
So what happens...
have read high fantasy.
Besides
read...
Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
So, the Dark Tower has parts of its story that are in a world completely made up of, you know, from imagination, and then there are some real world elements. Is it mid fantasy since it bridges the two?
No, low fantasy augments. Because even in that first book, like, the main kid and the gunslinger is from Earth.
But say, like, Wizard in Glass, that's completely in its own world all by itself. Or the Wolves of Kala is completely in a world outside of our world.
I would say Wizard in Glass is high fantasy because that entire book is all... It's all the fantasy world, but Wolves of Kala, there are Earth characters in...
Yeah, from...
And Father Callahan goes back to... Yeah, Boston.
It all ties back to Boston. To Beantown, baby.
It's infuriating.
The highest of fantasy. Beantown.
Boston, the highest of...
the Beantownian. Starring Bill Burr. I'd watch it. I'd totally watch it.
Well, you need, like, a whole party.
So you need
whole potty. You need Bill Burr, Ben Affleck, Dane Cook,
Anacha, Wicked Maid.
So as I was going down the fantasy rabbit hole, I started to be able to put some book series to authors that I've heard of.
Authors.
Did you ever hear of the series The Wheel of Time?
Yes. Didn't
you've never heard of that?
Somebody secured the rights to the Wheel of Time, and the rights were to make a TV series about it.
It seems appropriate.
And the period that they had to maintain the rights were running out of time or something like that. So they put together a, like, half an hour really shitty, like, pilot that they aired at 1 o'clock in the morning once, just to maintain the rights. I want to say that's true. Like, Fox did this or something like that.
Okay.
I don't know what The Wheel of Time is really about.
Well, I don't really know what it's about either, but it is one of the most bloated, long-running fantasy, high fantasy book series that there are. And, you know, like, you look at one of the books and it's like 800 pages. That in and of itself intimidates me. Ian, you were going to say?
I was just saying, in 2015, FX aired
there you go.
Winter Dragon, a low-budget 22-minute pilot for a potential The Wheel of Time series, solely so that they could maintain the rights.
Man, I've never heard of this.
Yeah,
who wrote the books?
Robert Jordan started writing them. And a lot of people say that, you know, they're relatively accessible and, you know, easy to read. I keep hearing they're easy to read. But it's like at the same time, they're like, he's really descriptive. I'm like, ah, that is word kryptonite to me. I hate overly descriptive things because it fails to ignite my imagination when I read that kind of stuff, because it's trying to tell me every last detail. And then I sort of like zone out because I'm bored because things aren't happening. So I can't stand that kind of writing. I have a book series that I have tried, and I've talked about it here before. I've tried so many times to get through it, and I could barely get past 100 pages of it. And that was Chris Claremont and George Lucas's Shadow War series, which is the sequel to Willow, the movie Willow. And they did a trilogy of books, and I was like, oh, this is going to be so cool. I love that world. I just couldn't do it. It was so bad. So, I don't know. What, before I die, maybe one day before I die, I will actually read that series. But I'm in no place to try it again right now. But anyway, so yeah, The Wheel of Time is like this big one. The other series that I'm kind of interested in is a series called The Sword of Shannara. Have you heard of The Sword of Shannara?
I have heard of The Sword of Shannara. I always get it confused with The Silmarillion, which is the Lord of the Rings prequel.
Right. The Sword of Shannara is related to Lord of the Rings in that it is considered a plagiarism of the Lord of the Rings.
Much like the Spider-Man costume was plagiarized.
It's the Ben Cooper.
All roads lead back to Ben Cooper.
Ain't that the truth? So, The Sword of Shannara apparently like was almost like a blow for blow copy of Lord of the Rings. And at the same time,
Bobo Fraggins. It's
no, but like there. Okay, so there's a in the Lord of the Rings. What's the name of the town that
The Shire?
The Shire. In
it's called the Fryer.
In the Sword of Shannara, it starts in a town called Shadyvale, and
oh, they're even Shadyvale. Get
Shadyvale that. Sounds too it sounds real like a world plan of for homes. Me. Yeah, it sounds. It doesn't well, sound the, fantastic
when you,
enough.
When you look at the map for the Sword of Shannara, a lot of the places have like more real world sounding locales,
like the land of McDonald's.
Well, maybe not quite.
In
like
in Blordor,
like Skull Volcano or something, Skull Mountain instead
Skull
of
Island.
Instead of like in the Belgariad, like all the locations are kind of confusing because they're weird sounding names, like
Urethra. Lake, we know where that town is.
Lake Kamar and Olgoland.
Your tongue committed suicide when you're trying to say that.
So like you're reading this book and you're like, I don't know what that means. So you always
Does
have to like look
it better
it up.
That it twists your mind?
No. I'm just saying that like there's a difference. I feel like when you use like real words,
Skull Town
or Lake Town, it's very much more like Lord of the Rings. Mm-hmm. Whereas like when you use more sort of like exotic names, it tends to like make you feel like, I don't know, it somewhat makes it feel a little bit more legitimate somehow.
But I think you can, personally, I have an allowance for normal words, like lake.
I have an allowance for normal words.
Yeah, I will.
What's
I will
your
allow
normal word allowance like, for the day.
If
is it
if like
100 words,
Lake Town,
sound familiar.
Lake Town, you know, Skull Mountain, like those don't pull me out of a fantasy book. But like Sunnyvale,
Shadyvale,
Yeah, it sounds like
totally
a
different.
It sounds like a Ryan Holmes plan. And Mr. Wolf, like if we're in a complete fantasy world, like I don't think. Mr. just stands out to me for some reason. Like
no, it was kind of like the nickname that the little kid gave him. His like other characters called him the Ancient One.
But why why does that word Mr. exist in that world?
It's a form of like.
I get it. Like it is in our world. Like
yeah,
it's like your salutation.
Yeah.
Like, but it sounds too. That sounds too real world to me. Okay. Mister sounds too real world to me. Like, no one's going around Lord of the Rings like, hey, Mr. Gandalf.
They do that all the time, Mr. Frodo.
He calls him Master Frodo.
He calls him both.
In the, I think they changed it in the movies. In the books, it's always Master Frodo. But, I mean, semantics. Okay. But for whatever reason, like, Mr. Wolf rubs against me.
Yeah. When you were watching the Lord of the Rings like movies, were you, like, pulled out because they kept saying Mr.? You're like, God damn it, it's Master! This,
yeah,
I feel
a little,
like...
A little bit, yes. Because I was like, why not
there
just...
There should be a McDonald's
why not
on the
just
cor-
use... Like, you've... Because, like, when I watch those movies, I'm like, you've dedicated yourself so much to being... To just... To... You've made... You've gone to such lengths to bring the page to the screen, and then, like, that you're going to change this one little thing. Like, who the fuck cares? Call him Master Frodo. Like, what are you worried about? Like, Sam's his fucking slave. It's a different fucking world. Who the fuck cares what master means in it? Just, you're going to go to all these great lengths to do all this shit, and then this is what you're going to balk at? Like, just do it.
Yeah. I hear you, although that did not bother me in the least, but I can understand how there are things that can pull you out of it that don't feel like they totally commit to the high fantasy of it. But apparently the Sword of Shannara has gone on to every book after the first one became its own thing. And I think, you know, basically salvaged the series. However, there are some people that adore the first book the most out of everything. And they even say it's better than Lord of the Rings, because like it,
because they stop at a Wendy's in it.
Well, I think because like
Master
they don't
Frodo, no,
because it's it's a more direct read,
not the Baconator.
Because they like get rid of the songs and stuff that are in the books. Like nobody reads the songs.
The Chocolate Frosty is something much different in Middle Earth. The songs fucking sucked. I loved reading Lord of the Rings, but every time I get to a song, I couldn't skip hard enough. I would skip so hard, I'd rip pages out. And all that entire Tom Bombadil stuff, it's like the worst shit committed to a page.
Well, they didn't put him in the movie.
I know.
And that's good, right?
Fuck yeah. Fucking right.
Well, the last thing I'll say about The Sword of Shannara is that was written by Terry Brooks. Does that name mean anything to either of you?
I think I know that name because of Song of Shannara, Sword of Shannara.
Sword of Shannara. Yeah. There's one called The Elf Song of Shannara. I think that's the second book. Or no, The Elf Stones of Shannara. And then the third one is The Wit...
Some Elf Stones, baby! Look at these Elf Stones!
The third one is called The Wish Song, I think. Of Shannara. Everything's of Shannara.
I don't like these titles. The elf
stones. I think as the series goes on, you realize that the setting is actually kind of unique because it's...
Look at these jewels, baby.
It's thousands and hundreds of thousands of years in the future. It's like after some kind of, you know, cataclysmic event that wiped out humanity and then evolution sprung up again. But this time now with like
Elves
and shit. And, you know, I guess you got to do something to set yourself apart. And that's kind of the hook for it. Although I don't think that happens in the first book.
There's a lot of that in The Dark Tower, too.
Okay.
Because all of a sudden, like, there's, like, old like, relics. But as he's describing them, you're like, oh, those are gas
stations. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's cool. Did you read any of the novelizations to the like Star Wars prequels back when they were new?
All of them. I think I did. I definitely read the first two.
Okay.
I think I read Sith. I'll have to look upstairs.
Okay.
I have the hardback for Attack of the Clones.
I have the hardback for all three. Paul, that means that you have read Terry Brooks.
Maybe that's why I know that name.
He wrote The Phantom Menace, which I think was the best of the three novelizations, actually.
After Attack of the Clones, I needed more context built into that story to make the movie work better for me. So that when I watched the movie, I was like, Okay, well, they just cut out.
I thought that book was rough.
All of these scenes. Yeah, I think, you know, I think the story in general just doesn't work. No matter how you put it all
that
together,
was by an
it
author.
Still has some weird choppy bits. But that's why I got it, to like, all right, what fill in these holes, put some mortar between these bricks.
The Attack of the Clones one was written by R.A. Salvatore, the same author that wrote Star Wars Vector Prime, who dropped a moon on Chewbacca's head. If you remember,
I don't know that.
The New Jedi Order books that came out.
Mm-mm.
It was like, I think the Star Wars books were in a little bit of a rut, and then they were trying to sort of shake things up, and they started, they did three lines of books. You had like the New Jedi Order, Jedi Legacy, and then like Legacy of the Force, something like that. And the first of those series started with a book called Vector Prime by R.A. Salvatore. And in that first book, they killed Chewbacca. They essentially dropped a moon on his head. So that's how they got rid of Chewbacca in the expanded universe.
Unfortunate.
It's so unfortunate when a moon drops on your head. which is funny now because he's the only remaining character alive in Star Wars. Yeah. But R.A. Salvatore, Ian, is the author that wrote those Drizzt fantasy books, the Dark Elf trilogy that I've sort of
didn't
been,
you like
been
those?
Powering through these many years.
No. I'm only halfway through the first book, and man, I like it has moments where it feels kind of cool, but like overall, it's a slog. And like I'm reading it, and I'm like, it's got to be me because everybody that's read these says this is like one of the best like fantasy stories out there, but it just is not clicking with me. I don't know.
Sometimes stuff just works for you and not other people, or for other people and not you. Like, I think part of the reason I had a hard time getting into The Talisman, like, the first so much of it was just a real slog. I was like, this book fucking sucks. And I think because it's not, like, for good or bad of the story, something about Stephen King's writing, I just blaze through it. Like I get the cadence, I get the words, like it's real easy for me to read. But since this was Stephen King and Peter Straub,
it would have been very different. It would have been like today at training camp.
Right.
Like Gunslinger took all the snaps.
There's just a much different like cadence and pace to it, to the phrasing, the wording. And like I think it took me like a third of the book to get into the groove of it. And like I read that Poe book, and that's all different. And like I've read other things, and Stephen King always seems to be where like my brain picks up the easiest. And like I feel in a similar sense, the music that I like is if I can remember the words and sing it easily, I'm going to like it better. Like if there's weird weird cadences and stops to the vocals, like it's not something that I'm going to want to go back to right away. And like I feel like that's a very me thing. So
it makes sense, though. There's a new Stephen King book out, I noticed, at the bookstore because there was like 9,000 copies of it. It's that hard case line, you know, that like sort of crime line you see, like they've made comic books under that imprint. And he has written three books under hard case so far. The first one was Joyland. Then he did The Colorado Kid. And now most recently he did Later. Now I read Joyland and I thought it was pretty good. So now I kind of want to read those other ones because those are shorter Stephen King books, which I feel like are some of the one of the more necessary elements of a Stephen King book is shortness, because he has a tendency, the longer it goes, the more boring it gets until he does something to draw you back into it.
Joyland sounds familiar. That may be upstairs, but Colorado Kid doesn't sound familiar.
Yeah.
But at some point, the Stephen King library quit. Like, I was getting all this stuff, and then all of a sudden, I wasn't getting anything, and so I'm like, now I need to go actually buy them.
Mm-hmm.
despicable.
The talisman's pretty thick. It's a good, you know.
You should get those hard case ones. They're well, I mean, I only read the one, but like if they're all the same style, then like they're really like good character driven.
I'll get it. Like I post stuff. I'm like, hey, I just finished the Talisman, you know, on Twitter, and everyone's like, oh, you ought to read this. You read this, and I'm like, settle down. My OCD demands that I go in chronological order. I'll get to Black House, and I'll get to 11, 23, 63, and Mr. Mercedes. I'll get to that stuff, but I'm only on 1985 right now. And at this point, he was writing 7 books a year. So, like, well, I'll get there.
Can I just make one quick comment, a pet peeve of mine? When I go to the bookstore, like not a used bookstore, but like a Barnes & Noble, and God bless them, they finally have a horror section, but just call it the fucking Stephen King section. That's all it is. It's like Stephen King, like whole bookshelf of Stephen King. Okay, I'll go over here and look at this book. Oh, that's Stephen King too. Then after that, like 3 Dean Koontz books and maybe like 2 Joe Hill before that. And that's your horror section. Enjoy.
Just make it the Stephen King section and like the horror shelf.
Yeah. Half. Yeah. I mean, there's more Westerns than there are non-Stephen King horror books. Speaking of horror books, Ian, I'm going to recommend something to you because I think you'll like it. It'll get you talking. It's okay. Richard Layman. Dick Layman. He has written some really salacious.
Oh, sexy horror.
Sexy horror. What is a...
An explicit horror novels.
Is there a particular one that I should look for?
The one that's on my list is Funland. But the one that I read from him was The Traveling Vampire Show. And I didn't love it at first, but the longer it has sat with me, the more I loved it. Paul, you would actually like that one. The cool thing about Layman books is they are breezy reads. Because they're just like reading like almost like a play script. It's just dialogue. So like you just like page after page turning so fast. And they're really quick reads.
Stephen King's Storm of the Century is written as a movie script. And it was kind of a weird way to read a novel.
Did it take place off the coast of Maine?
Yeah, I think it took place in a New England town. Someone always rooting for the Red Sox up there.
How quaint.
Yeah. I think that's going to do it for us tonight. My name is Paul McGinty.
Ian Sharpley.
Matt Cassell.
We'll see you next time.